as it happens in many authoritarian regimes, that people look to Bitcoin, look to stable coins, not as an investment, not as a luxury, not as a technology. They look for these alternatives as the solution to a problem. That the future of Bitcoin, the future of this incredible revolution that is taking place is in the Global South, because this is the part of the world where people use this technology again to solve a problem, and not just Venezuela.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Countries don't fall into dictatorship and authoritarianism overnight. For every military dictatorship, there are thousands, if not millions, of freedom fighters that risk their lives to save democracy. And many end up paying the ultimate price. From 2008 until 2015, myself and millions of other Venezuelans did just that. We protested peacefully. And the regime answered with lead bullets, not rubber ones. I was there. And I can tell you that those bullets were real. And so were the lives lost. When I heard those shots, I understood that the risks that we were all taking on those streets were also very, very real. But there was a reason to be there. A great one, actually. We had great political leaders risking everything, just like we were, to fight against Chavez and his cronies, to stop them from stealing democracy. Their actions inspired an entire country to engage in peaceful protests. One of these men who risked everything and more to save Venezuela was Leopoldo López, and his fight continues today. After joining many protests to support him over the years, I had the great privilege to sit down with him and learn about what drives him. I hope you enjoy this chat as much as I did. As a Venezuelan, it's an immense privilege and an honor to have this space and time to speak with you. You are a true Venezuelan hero in my books.
No, thank you. Thank you, my friend. Thank you, Mauricio. And it's a great pleasure to be with you. And I've also been following your work, your creativity, your innovation, and your capacity to put Venezuelan talent to the world.
The way we usually start the show is I ask people to tell me a little bit about their childhood.
Well, I was born in Venezuela during a time when Venezuela was an island of democracy in South America. It was a country at the time where, you know, democracy was a given, was like the oxygen. I was a very fortunate kid. I had the opportunity to meet my four grandparents, my parents, in a country with inequality less than what we have today. But I was fortunate enough to have an education, to have three meals a day. And I was playing all over the place. So I loved skateboarding, bike riding, horseback riding. And I played sports. I did combat sports since I was a kid. So I was a happy kid. Since my early childhood, I was always interested in Venezuela as a whole, because that was the conversation in my household. Venezuela in all of its aspects, you know, the nature, the geography, the history, politics, the economics. So that was something that since the very beginning, I knew that it was what I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to, which was my country, the well-being of the Venezuelan people.
Most kids in Venezuela don't grow up wanting to be a politician. Why did you decide to enter politics?
I had a passion for it. I had a passion for Venezuela. And the way to channel that passion for me was politics. In a way, I was always involved in school politics, in sports. You know, I was a captain of the teams that I participated in. But I always wanted to dedicate my life to Venezuela. So politics was a natural thing. And to tell the truth, I don't remember being a kid wanting to do something different than being in public service. And that's what I devoted my life to. I had the opportunity to study abroad. I studied in the United States. I spent 9 years, high school, college, and then graduate school. Then I went back immediately, but things started to change in Venezuela. Chavez won in 1999. At the time, I was teaching at the university, and we had a very interesting group that we were rethinking Venezuela and the institutions of Venezuela. So I decided to quit my job. Although I loved my job, I loved my passion even more.
In true autocrat fashion, the first thing Chavez did after becoming president was asking to rewrite the Venezuelan constitution. After winning the election to rewrite the constitution, a new election was held to determine who was to write it. And this was the assembly that Leopoldo first ran for when he was 25 years old. But he lost. The winners went on to rewrite the Venezuelan constitution in 180 days. Redrawing the social rule set for the entire country. Side note, if you ever see a newly elected president ask to rewrite the constitution, run. But Leopoldo didn't give up then. In fact, he was only getting started. After losing his first election, he decided to run for mayor of Chacao, one of the largest and most prominent municipalities in the country's capital of Caracas.
There were like seven candidates. I started my campaign with 2-3 points in the polling, and I was the underdog. I decided that I was going to shake as many hands as I could. So I would wake up at 5 in the morning and I was hunting for traffic. And there was a lot of traffic at the time in Caracas.
Leopoldo's message was direct.
My name is Leopoldo. I want to be your mayor. And this is what I want to do. And this is how I'm going to transform your city. I invite you to dream with me to make this dream come true. And it was something that at the time was a very big win because I was running against the nation Chavismo and also against the other political organizations that had been governing the city for many years. So that gave me an incredible opportunity to put ideas into practice and particularly to put a great team of very young, committed people that had training in different areas in urban planning, in finance, in legal areas, in public safety.
Promptly after winning the election, Leopoldo and his team began transforming his municipality. Chacao became the envy of all of Caracas and all of the country.
We built schools, we built a healthcare system, we changed the roads, we built sidewalks, parks, sports facilities, we changed the taxation system. We created a theater, and we did a lot of activities with the different cultural groups, and it was my dream job. I mean, there was nothing I would rather do at the time than what I was doing. But then, you know, things started to get difficult because what would have been a blessing became a curse.
Leopoldo was driving a lot of positive change. People in Caracas, or Caraqueños as we like to call them, were quickly noticing and talking about the improvements in Chacao. The word quickly got out to the rest of the country, and Leopoldo was generating a lot of buzz as a young leader with the potential to transform and modernize the city. The next step for Leo was to become governor of the city of Caracas. And it was coming. You could feel it in the air. It was coming. But Leo's work caught the eye of someone else. Hugo Chavez Frias. The Chavez regime placed all sorts of restrictions and sanctions on Lopez, disqualifying him from holding office after his term as mayor was up. Chavez saw Leopoldo as a legitimate contender in a democratic election, so he decided not to allow one. But what Chavez didn't foresee was how Venezuelans would react to Leopoldo's disqualification. By disallowing him, Chavez made Leopoldo into the leader of his own counter-revolution. I distinctly remember the movement that you started and how it inspired people all over the country, me being one of them. You had the entire system against you openly, like openly after you, but you did not back down. You pushed even more. And your actions, your defiance to the regime is what made them show their true colors and make them do the horrible things that they did. And can you explain a little bit about that stand that you took on that highway that day and what was the price that you paid for it?
In 2008, I was disqualified. So I was again unemployed and I decided to start another movement with a lot of young people, students, union leaders, community leaders. And I went around the country talking about nonviolent action, talking about civil resistance, talking about the system being a dictatorship, and talking about the reasons why we needed to speak out and show truth to power. So in January of 2014, we called for protest. The movement at the time was called the Exit, La Salida. Many people decided not to come with me. A couple of them, Maria Corina Machado, who's our candidate now, was one of them. And tens of thousands of people went to the street. They decided to repress and to start imprisoning the young people, the protesters. So in February the 12th, there was a protest, and the regime decided to take the repression a notch forward. So they killed three people that day. They killed a young student. He was a carpenter. His name was Basil da Costa. And he was killed by the detail guards of the Minister of Interior. That happened at 3 p.m. And by 6 p.m., there was a warrant for my arrest. So I decided to go into hiding. And I had three alternatives, either to flee the country, to stay in hiding, or to turn myself in. And I decided to turn myself in. So on February the 18th, I was censored. I was not able to go on TV or radio. And I called for people to join me. And hundreds of thousands of people came to the streets. Everybody dressed in white to show that we were peaceful, that we were nonviolent. So I was captured, detained by the military, and taken to a military prison where I spent the next 4 years in solitary confinement. During that period, I was sentenced to 14 years of imprisonment.
But Leopoldo wouldn't end up serving the 14 years in prison. After 4 years of being cut off from the world, from his people, and in solitary confinement, he was released and placed under a strict house arrest instead.
And then during another cycle of protests in 2017, I was sent to house arrest. From house arrest, I decided to call again to support the protest. So they sent me back to military prison. That was the worst time. It was going from purgatory to back to hell.
Between 2014 and 2019, Leopoldo spent his life bouncing between military prison, solitary confinement, and house arrest.
So I spent the next year and a half in house arrest. And in the middle of 2019, with the collaboration of the police and the guards from the military that were surrounding my house, I was liberated. And another cycle of protests took place that day.
Chavez died in 2013, but his regime continued ruling thanks to an unfair election held in 2014. After that election, a group of Venezuelan military personnel, politicians, and academics launched what they called Operation Freedom on April 30th, 2019. This operation was calling for the removal of Nicolás Maduro as president and demanding free and fair elections for Venezuela. During this unrest, Leopoldo was freed from house arrest after being imprisoned for 5 years.
Things didn't go out exactly how we wanted them to go, so I had to seek refuge at the Spanish embassy, where I stayed the next year and a half. After 7 years, I decided to escape Venezuela against my will. I never wanted to do that. I live and breathe Venezuela. I have a tattoo of Venezuela in my leg.
Leopoldo wasn't alone. My family and I also had to escape Venezuela against our will. Neither of us ever wanted that. And neither did the 7.7 million people that have left the country since 2015. Leopoldo, his family, and mine are all included in those numbers. It was a difficult realization, but I knew that if I wanted to fight for my country to be free, I had to leave and fight from abroad.
So it was one of the most difficult decisions that I made. I was to leave my country, to leave the people. I had no way of continuing the fight inside Venezuela. So that took me to exile. So I came to Spain, where my family had been living in exile because they were also harassed and threats on my family. I joined my family, and since then, I've been living in exile and reshaping the fight. I continue to fight the fight from a different perspective, from a different position, but I continue to fight the fight for freedom, which is what motivates me. for people like you, like me, like millions of Venezuelans, and I can tell you, like billions of people in the world, freedom is not a theoretical thing. Freedom is not an abstract. Freedom is not something that you read about in poetry or in books. Freedom is something you live and breathe. And you live and breathe freedom because you don't have it, because you have been shut down, because you have been detained, because you are scared of speaking out, because freedom is a collective circumstance. It's not just one thing. But if you talk to any Venezuelan or any people, any person that lives under an autocratic regime, they can talk about freedom in a very concrete, direct way and vital way.
You're a revolutionary man. You know, you fought once, you lost, you fought again. They weren't fair with you, you lost again. You got up and you fought again. The regime, with all the system, with all the power, they went down against you again. And you stood up and fought and called for protests again. And now, just because you're outside of the country doesn't mean you're not fighting a revolution. And this is where our paths cross, because you and I met at the Oslo Freedom Forum, which is a forum for freedom fighters around the world. Freedom fighters around the world now have a new tool, a tool that is helping them do a lot more things. And this tool is Bitcoin. And you and I both found Bitcoin through our different paths and our different journeys. But I would love to know a bit about, when did Bitcoin come onto your radar?
It was 2020, when I was in house arrest at the time. Juan Guaido was the interim president of Venezuela. COVID was, of course, a reality in all of the world, including Venezuela. And we had an opportunity to figure out ways to help medical doctors and nurses. So there were some funds that were seized by the U.S. government, and I came up with a proposal to get part of these funds to help the medical doctors and nurses that were earning, at the time, $3 and $5 per month. In a country where that means absolutely nothing, figuring out a way of getting cash to people that needed cash, that had no other way of getting it but through new technologies. That's how I came across with cryptocurrency. And we put together a proposal, and I told my colleagues in Venezuela, and then we worked with the U.S. that had to give a license for the use of these funds, that we put together a cash transfer directly to the Venezuelan people, to medical doctors and nurses, using a stable coin.
Stable coins are tokens that represent a U.S. dollar and are backed by U.S. dollars. They have become wildly popular internationally as people use them as digital dollars for everyday payments and transactions.
We got a green light from the Alliance, a green light then, after a lot of work from the U.S. Treasury Department and from OFAC. And we got the first license that OFAC ever gave for a cryptocurrency. That happened in 2020. We were able to identify and to sign on board 85,000 medical doctors and nurses, and we were able to do the magic, to have the funds in the U.S. And with all of the restrictions, we were unable to have bank accounts, because this is something that people need to understand. In authoritarian regimes, there is a financial apartheid for those people and those organizations that are against the regime. So you cannot go through the banking system, the private or the public banking system. So the limitation is the invitation to creativity. So how do we do this? Well, now technology provides a way of doing this through your smartphone. And you can do this with downloading a wallet, and boom, then the magic happens. You send, you know, the resources from the U.S. or from anywhere in the world, and we'll get it in Venezuela. So we put together a team. They searched for the best alternative. We figured out that the best alternative at the time was a wallet that had something very important that was not, they had no links to the financial system in Venezuela, and they had this network of human ATMs where people would get the funds to their smartphones, and then they would identify one of these exchangers or human ATMs and they would get cash. You know, as things evolved, they could pay with their smartphones in certain businesses. So it became, you know, an alternative to thousands of people. It became an alternative to us. And at the time, it was also becoming a reality for millions of Venezuelans, like it happened in Argentina, like it happened. We were facing hyperinflation at the time, as it happens in many authoritarian regimes, that people look to Bitcoin, look to stable coins, not as an investment, not as a luxury, not as a technology. They look for these alternatives as the solution to a problem. That the future of Bitcoin, the future of this incredible revolution that is taking place is in the global south, because this is the part of the world where people use this technology again to solve a problem, and not just Venezuela. I have seen that there are similar stories. So at some point, 100,000 people were involved in this network, and we were transferring funds to activists, to medical doctors, to nurses, to NGOs. We were getting donations, and it's all very transparent. It's all very direct. I mean, it's all out there in the blockchain, and it's just very simple for people to use, increasingly so. You know, as time goes by, it becomes more simple, more intuitive. And I have seen how this is an incredible tool for humanitarian initiatives, and also for what keeps me awake at night and makes me motivated to be every day that I wake up, that is the struggle for freedom in Venezuela and beyond.
I was following that effort that you did, sending those USDC down to people in Venezuela. And I distinctly remember, for me, it was the first time I ever saw the US government work with any other country or group to send stablecoins or digital assets to any other country. I can't state how massive this is and what you guys accomplished in doing so. And the other one is that, to remind everyone listening, is that you're not fighting a fair fight when you're trying to topple a dictatorship and when you're trying to help people get their democracy back. They're going to do whatever they can so that you can't get education in, resources in, whether that's finance or health or food. They won't allow it. And stablecoins and crypto just pierces through that. And one of the things that I've noticed as I've left Venezuela is how similar our problems are to everyone else's problem. And it seems like every dictatorship gets the same book at school and they get the same game plan.
Let me tell you what I've been doing since I left Venezuela. I continue to be, of course, involved in Venezuela and all of our struggle. But I started to meet people. The same way I met you at the Oslo Freedom Forum, I met other people from countries that are facing the same struggle. People from Iran, from Afghanistan, from China, from Hong Kong, from Zimbabwe, from Chad, from Nicaragua, from Cuba, and started to realize that it was the same story in different languages, in different contexts, but the same story. Started to meet people that had also been political prisoners, people that have been forced into exile, people that had been victims of the smear campaigns of the dictatorships. So I decided that my way of channeling my drive for freedom was to create a new movement. That's what I've been doing since I was a kid, creating movements. So I decided to work with other fellow freedom activists from all over the world, a global movement for freedom and democracy. So we put together an initiative called the World Liberty Congress that focuses in getting together democracy defenders, freedom fighters from autocratic regimes in order to support each other, learn from each other, and to have a strong voice together. Because we realize that our struggles in each one of our countries goes through the media cycle. So at one point, you might be at the spotlight, and then you're not. But when you frame the issue as a global issue, simple, this is autocracy versus democracy, tyranny versus freedom. And it's happening all over the world. And then we realized that we were talking about 70% of the world's population, and more than 60 countries in the world were living under very similar struggles. And we also realized, and this is critical, that, as you say, autocrats are learning from each other. They have the same playbook. They are working together. They are learning from each other. And on the freedom side, we were not doing this. So we launched the Liberty Congress. We had our first event a year ago. We had Then we launched an initiative called the Freedom Academy that we teach people about civil resistance, nonviolent movement, and financial freedom, and the tools of stablecoins and Bitcoin. So we've done activities and workshops in Africa, in Latin America, in Taiwan, and in many other places, linking movements, activists in this similar worldview. Because even though our cultures are very different, and you can, you know, find all of the reasons why we're different, religion, skin color, institutional buildup, history, climate. Now we have a very robust institution with more than 50 countries represented, 56 particularly. We, in our last event that took place 3 weeks ago, we approved our founding documents, we approved our governance structure, the programs that we are working with. And one of them is technology and freedom, and particularly Bitcoin and freedom. Because when you talk to all of these leaders, to all of these movements, this is the same challenges that they are facing. So how do I get resources into our country? How do we get resources privately? How do we get these resources immediately? How do we get these resources without putting anybody at risk? How do we get these resources at the right time when it's needed? And the answer to this is Bitcoin stablecoin. There is no other way. You know, getting cash through borders or using the financial system of the regime is not an option.
I was lucky enough to be at the human rights event when Leopoldo announced the creation of the World Liberty Congress. The atmosphere that night was electric. It was a room packed with freedom fighters. I could not have been more excited. According to the World Liberty Congress, it is estimated that 70% of the global population are living under autocracy. The question is, how could this 70% free themselves from their regimes? For many, it starts with money.
I have a view going forward for a free Venezuela where Bitcoin has an important part, giving people the opportunity to store value, giving people the opportunity to get the remittances, giving people the opportunity to be balanced, to be more free financially speaking. And of course, I think this is going to be an important tool towards the election in 2024. It's going to be a difficult election. It's going to be full of obstacles, not a regular election. When we talk about an election in Venezuela, we're not talking as if this was an election in the U.S. or even in Argentina, where they can vote and just decide, and then the people decide. In the case of Venezuela, we're facing a dictatorship. Anything that they can in order to remain in power and in order to do the things that they can to limit the capacity of organizing. And of course, getting funds is a big part. So I think it's going to play a big role.
Bitcoin is quickly gaining a reputation for being freedom money. And it is being embraced by a new wave of politicians that are revitalizing Latin American politics, like Javier Milei, who was recently elected president of Argentina and wants to eliminate the central bank and let its citizens choose whatever currency they want to use. There's also Nayib Bukele in El Salvador, who was the first nation to ever make Bitcoin legal tender back in 2021. Because of this and several other policies, Bukele is celebrated with a very high approval rate. I believe that countries that adopt Bitcoin will continue reaping the benefits, like El Salvador and Argentina are doing right now. And the rest of Latin America is watching. Don't you think people in Nicaragua and Guatemala also want hard money, more jobs, and more tourism? People all over the world are learning that Bitcoin equals opportunity.
I think the real challenge is going to be the delivery of that. The delivery in different ways. Because there are different ways in which you get Bitcoin adoption. There is making Bitcoin legal tender. And I think that's positive for Latin American economies. But there will always be the issue of how you deal with the bad use of cryptocurrency. Because we also need to be aware that like any financial tool, you have a positive side and a negative side. So one of the things that I've been focusing on, and I hope to publish a paper early next year, I'm calling it Bitcoin Adoption in Venezuela, Two Sides of the Coin. So I want to present the way in which the dictatorship has used cryptocurrency in order to launder funds and in order to evade sanctions, with concrete policy recommendations, how this can be addressed by the U.S. and other governments, but also talking about the positive view side. If you go to the East Coast in the U.S., most of the conversation is about, when you talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, most of the conversation is about money laundering, regulation, evasion of sanctions. If you go to the West Coast, most of the conversation is about how this new technology is changing the lives of people or potentially changing the lives of people. So I take a Midwest approach. You need to talk about the problem of cryptocurrency like any other financial instrument being used for money laundering or sanctions evasion. And you also need to talk about the potential positive side of billions of people being able to be banked, being able to have an account, being able to get their remittances, being able to store value of their money, which is a huge issue in countries with hyperinflation or high inflation rates, like the case of Venezuela and many other countries. Going forward, we need to address the threats and the potential of this new technology. And we are at a very early stage. When you talk to people like you, who are experts on this, we are, if you compare Bitcoin to the internet, we're in the early 1990s still.
The fight for freedom in Venezuela hasn't had the happy ending that many of us dreamed about. Fighting against tyranny is unfair, and many of us have been forced to fight from abroad to protect our livelihoods. At first, it was a feeling of helplessness. Before Bitcoin and crypto, it was impossible to send money to someone in Venezuela. The regime was the sole gatekeeper of the entire financial system. But Bitcoin changed the game. Leopoldo pioneered the first program ever where a foreign government sent financial aid into Venezuela without needing the approval of the ruling regime, or without needing access to the local banking system. Once Venezuelans experience digital dollars in stablecoin format and Bitcoin, there is no going back. Slowly, one by one, Venezuelans will rediscover their financial freedom and reclaim their monetary independence thanks to Bitcoin. Political leaders that recognize this potential and embrace it can transform their countries and shift the balance of power in the region. We are already seeing this shift happen with Bukele and Milei. Hopefully, the wave of change can come to Venezuela next. Like Leo, I never wanted to leave. Venezuela was and will continue to be my home. But I knew that I would never be able to invoke change while remaining in the country. I knew I had to leave in order to make an impact. We know that one day we will take back our home. We just don't know when that is yet. Gracias, Leo, for taking the time to speak with me today and for the work that you do and continue to do for the people of Venezuela. To check out all of the work that Leopoldo and the World Liberty Congress are doing, you can visit their website, which you can find in the link in the description of this episode. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.